Space, the final frontier. This is the podcast that will look into the production secrets of Star Trek with a very special guest, because your geek history lesson on Star Trek production is now in session. Hello and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I am Jason Volcanis Inman.
I am Ashley Victoria Robinson. Welcome to your Mind University, because you have stumbled onto the podcast where we take one character construct or secret job from popular culture and teach you everything you need to know about it in about an hour. And we're doing another secrets episode this week.
Yeah, Ashley, in case this is somebody's first episode of Geek History Lesson, we've been doing a series of these. We did secrets of comic book letterers. We did secrets of... I forgot the secrets episodes. They've become so secret to me. We've done a bunch of these. We're peeling back the curtain on certain parts of the pop culture industry.
Comic book inking, comic book shops.
Yeah, and now we're doing a very interesting one, because we're talking about a very unique story. We're talking about a person that went from production assistant to producer in one of the biggest franchises in Hollywood history. It's fascinating. We're going to get a lot of interesting stories here, and I think it's kind of inspiring. And Ashley, this is fun for me, because this is, in my opinion, I think I'm correct on this, the first guest that we will ever open the hailing frequencies for. So let's just do that right now. Our very special guest is a producer who has credits on Star Trek the Original Series, Star Trek the Next Generation, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Star Trek Voyager, Star Trek Enterprise, Star Trek Nemesis, and Star Trek First Contact. And he is known professionally as Dave Rossi. Please welcome Dave to the show. Dave, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is an honor to have you, sir. And I also have Red Alert for you in case you want that. There you go.
I see you're mixing your sound effects. You've got 23rd and 24th century.
Oh, yes, we do, my friend. Yes, we do. And that's how you know Dave is a real deal, because we can recognize that stuff. But you know what? I'm that kind of nerd with you, where there are certain times on certain Star Trek shows where they'll use a, you know, sound effect not from the proper time period, and I'll pull up my nerd glasses and be like, incorrect.
We've all been there.
Yes. So, Dave, let's start with the very first obvious question. Were you a fan of Star Trek before you started working on Star Trek proper?
I grew up as an enormous Star Trek fan. I started watching when I was, 6 or 7 years old. It had just started in reruns. And, most of my contemporaries at the time, as I was growing up, had this very iconic poster of Farrah Fawcett hanging on their bedroom walls. And she's in this red bathing suit with her hair tossing back. And I had the Enterprise, and Star Trek was foundational for me in how I started thinking about the world. And it was a very, very important part of my life indeed.
Now, Dave, how did you get your first gig working on Star Trek The Next Generation?
First of all, I had no intention of becoming involved in the show. I think at one point I did send a letter to Richard Arnold, who was a researcher who worked on the show and was tied to Gene Roddenberry. And I said to him, hey, I'm a big Star Trek fan and I know everything about it. And if you ever need some help, I'd love to be on the show. I think that's as far as that ever went. But I had no intention of doing it. And I'm from Buffalo, New York, and I went into the Air Force. I got out in 1988, I think it was. And I went back to Buffalo, and there was a very depressed job market. I was a repo man, doing home furnishings and home electronics and appliances. It was absolutely miserable. And my dad at the time received a letter from an old acquaintance of his. And in the letter was a picture of his eighth grade baseball team. And at the time, my father was in his mid to late 50s. And the letter that accompanied it said, I don't know if you remember me. This is a picture of our eighth grade baseball team. And those were the happiest days of my life. And I have come into a job that has allowed me the means to do a lot of things. And I'm wondering if you would help me try and find everyone in this picture so that I could gather us all for a reunion.
Oh, wow.
And so they did. They found all but two people. Two of the men in the picture had died in World War II.
So we're pre-internet, just so everyone appreciates the amount of effort that would have gone into finding these people.
Completely. Yeah, there was no internet. There was none of that. None of those kinds of
shortcuts. This would be Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, like the mid-80s?
This would have been 1989.
Okay.
Beginning of 1989. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, my father, through whatever networks they had, they found a lot of these people. A lot of them had stayed in Buffalo. People didn't tend to move out, into the world a lot in those days. And so a lot of them were kind of insular and still in Buffalo. And so anyone that wasn't, this guy who sent the letter to my father, his name was Chuck, he flew them in. And so they actually found one of their old, he went to a Catholic school, and they found one of the nuns was still alive, who was one of the teachers. And they rented a hotel, like little convention hall. And they had like this 2 or 3 day event where he scheduled all these events. They had these special jackets made. But it was funny that they all had to wear name tags because none of them, recognized each other. and they needed someone to videotape it. And where I worked, it was one of these rental centers. They had VCRs and camcorders. And so I borrowed one for a long weekend. And I told my dad, I'll videotape it for you. And so for the weekend, I videotaped all of these little ceremonies and dinners and all these people kind of reconnecting and so forth. And my father spoke to Chuck and said, listen, my son is a repo man. He's miserable. Is there anything available where you are that could help? And he lived in California and he was a vice president of a housing construction company. He said, well, why don't you have him drive out to California and I'll put him to work digging ditches to start and we'll see where it goes. And so I did. In September of 1989, I packed my little Nissan Sentra and drove out to California and was literally a ditch digger in Lancaster for these new housing projects. I was digging ditches for jacuzzis, in-ground jacuzzis, and all these wacky things. And every couple of weeks, because the company had a lot of different projects going, Chuck would show up and he would take me out to dinner and he would just, tell me stories about growing up and with my dad. And, it was really, really nice. And he took a liking to me and they took me out of digging ditches and eventually moved me into customer service. And so as people would start occupying these homes, I would be the person who would be their initial contact as far as what's wrong, right? You've just moved into this new house. What's wrong? Well, this outlet doesn't work and this thing doesn't work and I need paint here. And so I would kind of wrangle all of that. And one weekend, there was going to be a Star Trek convention and it was a Next Generation convention. And it was right after Best of Both Worlds Part One had aired. And I'm out here in California. I don't really know anyone. The only people I know are the people who are on my job site. And I thought, I'm going to go try and find my tribe, right? So I'm going to go. It was in Los Angeles. I was in Lancaster, and it was in at the Los Angeles Hilton Airport downtown, not downtown, near the airport. And so I went to this Star Trek convention, and I brought my camcorder. And back then camcorders were like, Volkswagens. I mean, they were these giant.
Yeah, were they the VHS tape camcorders?
Yes, you put the VHS tape inside.
And how heavy, just off the top of your head, do you think something like that would have been?
It wasn't too bad, but I'm sure it was, 5 to 10 pounds.
All right. I mean, so like lugging a cat around.
Yeah. Right. And it had a big, heavy black case that, you know, you could keep an extra tape in and a battery pack and whatever.
Easier than digging ditches. I'll tell you that.
It was. Digging ditches was no fun for real. In fact, it was funny because the first word of Spanish that I had learned was agua, because I was
good one.
I was out there digging these ditches in Lancaster where it's like, you know, 110 degrees. And I was working with a lot of the people working around me didn't speak English, but they spoke Spanish, and they would see me suffering there. You know, I've got like calluses on my hands and I'm just a sweaty mess. And they would look at me and say, agua. And I didn't know what it was at first. And then I became very aware of what agua was, very receptive.
So you ended up recording just footage at this convention at the airport?
Yeah. Standing in the back of the room. And I don't remember what I was filming at the time, but this guy sticks his head in front of the camera and he says to me, you know, you're not supposed to be taping this. And I was very chagrined and I was like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. And he kind of laughed and he said, no, I'm just kidding. I'm actually about to go up and speak. And I said, oh, who are you? And he said, my name's Eric Stillwell. And he told me he was a script coordinator on the show, but also that he was a co-author of the story Yesterday's Enterprise, which was one of my favorite episodes. And so he said, stick around and watch. And he was there with his dad. It was his dad's birthday. And so his dad stood in the back with me and we watched Eric's spiel on stage. And then he came back down and he said, I'm just going to lunch with my dad. Do you want to hang out with us? And I said, yeah, sure. You know, I'm there alone. Go out and talk to somebody on the show. And I had no idea how TV worked, how Hollywood worked, what went into making a show. No idea. So we sat down and we really hit it off and ended up spending the entire weekend together. I just hung out with them the whole weekend. We'd have lunches and dinners together. And afterwards, he had said to me, you know, boy, if you're ever in the neighborhood and you're ever around the studio lot or something, give me a call and, you know, you can come onto the lot. And I was like, oh, that's, you know, fantastic. And one of those kind of niceties you say, and then you go back to your life. And the next day, I had to be to work at 5 a.m. And the next day at 5:30 a.m., they called us all into the office and handed us our last checks and said the company's bankrupt.
Go! Oh.
And so I was terrified and, you know, all the things that go with that happening. And I really, really didn't want to go back to Buffalo with my tail between my legs. Not that there was much there for me anyway. And so I called Eric and I said, listen, he was happy to hear from me. And he said, oh, it's only been a day. Are you in the neighborhood? And I said, no. I said, I'm wondering if there's any jobs there. And we talked kind of through it. I told him what had happened. And he said, boy, there, you know, there's nothing right now. He said, but what I could probably do is get you an interview with the Page staff at Paramount, which is the tour guides. And I said yes, and he arranged it. And the next week I drove up and had my interview. And, you know, it's painfully clear I had no idea about what the future would hold. I had no plan. I had no, you know, because these people, the people interviewing me were asking me, so what do you want to do in the business? And I don't know.
Ditches.
Exactly.
They're like, I like his gym.
Not go back to Buffalo. I said, but listen, I'm an incredibly hard worker. I'll do whatever you need. I'll always be there. I'm always on time. I just kind of gave them this spiel and I walked out feeling really defeated. They're never going to pick me for this. All the things they asked me about the business, I had no clue. And by the time I got back to Lancaster, there was a message on my machine saying they'd like to offer me the job.
Woo!
Yeah. And so I started with a group of, I don't know, there was maybe like 30 of us. And it's funny, one of the people who was in my class at the time was Victoria Alonso, who is now you see her name plastered as an executive producer all over the Marvel films. She is a visual effects and post-production person. And so it's always nice. I always see these names popping up, and it's great to see, you know, the old alma mater kind of making it. But anyway, so I became a page. And for the first 10 months, I did what the pages do. We gave tours to people on the lot, and we also were used for audience seatings.
When you talk about an audience seating, do you remember what was one of the shows that you seated the audience there at that time?
Cheers.
Oh, interesting.
That's cool.
I was waiting for you to say like Donahue.
Oh, yeah. No. Arsenio Hall.
Okay.
Very cool.
Yeah, Arsenio Hall was fun, but it was the worst one because they would give out free tickets all day long, and then they would tell you to come to the studio, but there was only so many seats. So you always had to turn away 300 people, you know? Yeah, it was always an ugly thing. So Cheers and a couple others. We also did things at other studios as well. I mean, we did one weekend, we did a Soul Train. We did... I don't now remember the name of the show. We did a show that starred Richard Lewis and Jamie Lee Curtis. Anything But Love.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, Anything But Love.
And
it was done on the Fox lot. And I think it was the Fox lot. And so we would drive out there and do it. And I happened to be running I was the whatever team captain or whatever that night. And we had to, one of the instructions for this particular show was, there are 5 seats in the front, and you must always put a piece of tape across them that says reserved for whatever station it was on, NBC executives or CBS executives. And you were never allowed to give those seats away. Even if nobody ever showed up, those seats would always remain empty. Mm. Okay, you got it. Well, we're starting to seat the audience, and Jamie Lee Curtis comes out and says to me, I'd like to sit my family in those empty seats. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I have very, very strict instructions that these are for the executives.
And then she was like, I'm Lori from Halloween. How dare you? No.
Yeah. She screamed at me.
I would be truly devastated if that was the story. I'm not going to lie.
Well, it escalated because she started, she was the star of the show.
Of course.
And she was letting me know that. And it was getting very loud, and I had to stand by my gun. I mean, it's a no-win situation. I'm standing there in my polyester page jacket, and it's like, yeah. There's no winning it. So, but I said, I'm sorry, I really can't do that. I can't do that. And she used the old line, "You will never work in this town again." And that was the first time I'd been bitched out by a celebrity. it was something. But so we, as pages,
I like that you said first time, implying that there are more times.
Oh, I'm sure there are. Yes. Yeah, I'm sure there are. So I did the kind of page routine. And one of the things they also did with the page staff is they used us as temporary work for different areas around the lot when people would call in sick. So for instance, if someone from the mail room called in sick, they still needed to make the mail runs. And so they would, have a page go over there and fill in. And I would always volunteer for every kind of job that, any kind of crap job that came up, I would volunteer for. Because I was interested now in learning about the lot and learning about the studio and how it worked. And so any jobs that put me in different places, I thought would be beneficial. And so, sure enough, you the mail jobs were always great because you got to go into so many different places and you could kind of see what people were doing and talk to people. And so that it worked out really well. And then Patrick Stewart, this is my first encounter with Star Trek. Patrick Stewart was running a Shakespeare workshop on the lot, and he requested a page come and the class was taking place in what was called at the time the Crosby Building, which was the scoring stage on the lot, which is no longer there. But it had this kind of long hallway, and so actors would who were taking the class would come in and sign in and sit in this hallway until Patrick was ready for them. And so I would sit there and check them in and, you know, do you need water? Do you need whatever? And I did that for a couple of days. And afterwards, I said to Patrick, and he came out and thanked me for working it. And I said, listen, I'm sure you have a lot of assistance and don't need this. I said, but I'd like to give you my resume. And if you ever are looking for someone, I'd love for my name to be thrown in the ring. And he said, thank you very much. And he was very gracious and very kind. And then I went about my job. And so that was my first interaction. And then the other thing that the Pages did was they worked in the studio store. And at the time, the studio store was, it sold very, very few things. It sold sweatpants and sweatshirts and t-shirts. And then it had a little kiosk that sold cookies and little kind of things like that, little sundries. And I worked there for a couple of months. And while I was working there, Star Trek VI was shooting. And after work, it's about 5:30 or so, I walked down to stage 11 because I heard they were going on location that night, but that was kind of a staging area. And so I go to this stage and there's a Klingon sitting out there smoking a cigarette. And I walked up to him and I said, well, how do you get into doing this? And he started telling me about central casting and what it meant to be an extra. And as he's talking to me, this very harried assistant director comes running out and says, are you here to spec? And I look at the Klingon. I didn't know what that meant. And the Klingon looked at the AD and said, yeah, yeah, he's here to spec. And so they said, well, let's go. And so they take me, this AD takes me, they bring me into wardrobe, and these wardrobe people start undressing me. And I had no idea what was going on. And I'm sure that was apparent on my face because the guy says, you seem weirded out. Are you here to spec? And I said, I honestly don't know what that means. And the guy laughed and he said, well, it means that you're here hoping that an extra who had already performed this work is not coming back for some reason, and you're hoping to jump into their shoes. And I said, sure, yeah, I'm here to spec. And so they put me in this prison uniform, and they put us on a bus, and they shipped us off to Bronson Canyon, and we filmed all night. The scene in Star Trek VI where Kirk has to fight the blue alien.
So you're in the background of that scene?
I'm somewhere in there, yeah.
All right. And,
I can see it there's a publicity still where you can see me, because what the guy did was he was so nice, and I was so freaked out because I didn't understand what was happening or what was required of me. I was just really weirded out. He said, you know, he took out this big, long, gold colored kind of lamé scarf thing, and he wrapped it around me like a winter scarf around my mouth, and then had it kind of draped down over my front. And he said, you're the only person who has this. So
sorry.
He said, you're the only person who has this. So when you see the movie, look for that and you'll know
the golden scarf.
Identify yourself, you know? Yeah.
And well, there was a publicity. That's what the phone ring was about. The golden scarf.
Ding. So I go and there's William Shatner, who Captain Kirk is my hero. I mean, it's Captain Kirk and Superman. And there I am with Captain Kirk, and DeForest Kelly's there. And it was for how important and how life changing Star Trek was for me to be there was simply nuts. And I filmed, you know, we're there all night long. 6-7 o'clock in the morning, they put us back on the bus, they ship us back, I get dressed, I go to work. I mean, right to work. And I was just giddy and full of adrenaline. And my boss was like, what is going on with you? And I, you know, blather out this story at 100 miles an hour. And he goes, okay, you need to go home. Just go home and sleep. And then, you know, we'll see you tomorrow. And I went home and I called my parents and I was just like, I was in the movie. And then they're like, what? You know, it was just this whole crazy thing. And shortly after that, Eric Stillwell called me and said, hey, listen, we have a job opening for a production assistant, which is basically a gopher on the show. It's a lot of running around, you know, riding a bike back and forth. You handle script revisions and lunches and all kinds of crazy stuff, whatever they need. And I was like, yeah, I'll go interview for it. And so I interviewed with a woman named Mary Howard, who at the time was a line producer. And she was the unit production manager at the time. And she gave me this interview and said, you know, do you know a lot about the show? And I said, no, not really, because Eric said, you got to play down your fandom. Because they don't like to hire people who are fans because they're afraid work won't get done.
Oh, interesting.
So it'll be, you know, people will be too busy goofing around on the sets and playing with props and wanting to talk to the actors. And it's just, play it down. So I did. And I ended up getting the job. And that was, I started on May 13th, 1991. And then my last day on the Star Trek franchise was May 13th, 2005. I think it was like, it was 14 years to the day. And so I started in the fifth season of Next Generation, and, you know, I made myself indispensable. I was there for everyone. It was like, you couldn't ask a question and not have me pop up and go, yeah, I'll do that for you. I tried to be everywhere. And then after work was done, I would go down to the stage because we would shoot, you know, oftentimes till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. And I would just be there. I would just hang out with Mary and make myself indispensable. And, a lot of times, go ahead.
I was gonna say, Dave, let me ask you this question. From your time working on Star Trek, The Next Generation, how would you describe the feeling and the tone of that show's set since you watched so many of the episodes being filmed?
Well, by the time I got there, as far as a production goes, it was a very, very well-oiled machine. So we had a whole bunch of autonomy. There were not network notes and studio notes, and they kind of let us do our thing because the show was so incredibly popular at that point. And yeah, I mean, you couldn't go anywhere without someone either saying that they knew a Star Trek fan or they were a Star Trek fan. And so, so that side of it, it was just working. It was just a very smooth operation. The feeling on the set was one of family. I mean, it was I really long for those days. It was just such a lovely time, and the cast was all just wonderful, and the crew was wonderful, and we were, you know, all everyone had a real belief in what we were doing. We everyone felt like we were doing something that mattered to people, and that goes a long way, you know, as far as attitude. And look, it was still work. You're there more hours than you are with your own family.
Well, let me follow up this, just in case somebody doesn't know. On the Star Trek TNG set, this is your first time as a production assistant. You know, and many people, you know, production assistant, you were correct. They are very much are the gopher. They literally do anything that's been asked. But what do you think was the most common thing you were asked to do on the Next Generation set as a production assistant?
I think our biggest role was script revisions.
Okay.
Of making sure people get script revisions, because they happened a lot. And, a page here, 2 pages here, 4 pages here. And the distribution list was enormous. So it's not just everybody on set, but there's people all around the lot and all the departments who need to get these things. And so I would say that was the most important.
Were the scripts, now this is very common, this is still common in Hollywood today, that people are constantly rewriting the scripts, certain pages
on set often.
On set. Let me ask you this. Was the TNG scripts, were they a last minute deal as well? Like, were you constantly getting pages like right before a scene was being filmed?
That happened, but not quite to that timing. But there were occasions when that did happen. But it was more of a constant. There were constantly tweaks coming out to the next day's work or that evening's work, and it was in the morning. There were times when things came out, you know. There was an interesting, I don't know how it is now, but there was a very purposeful delineated line, which was the writers don't come down to the stage. And so if the actors had questions about something or wanted to make changes, they would call up to Rick Berman's office, and then Rick would tackle that with the writers. And so that's how the process worked.
But Dave, if I may interrupt you there, I want to ask the question, because that is not, to me, from my experience, a common thing. And I've heard that story from so many other TNG, DS9, and Voyager writers, where the writers were not allowed on set. And now it's on every show, like a writer goes to set as sort of the voice of the writer's room to make sure that the tone is being like correctly delivered, but also to make sure that, you know, the actors, the director don't add something that could ruin something down the line. Now, I know, I realize that TNG was not as serialized as like our modern media is, but do you know what was the reason for that rule? Like, why were writers not allowed on the Next Generation DS9 Voyager sets?
I couldn't tell you what the actual reason was. It was in place before I got there, but it was something that I don't know if it was instituted with Gene Roddenberry, who, you know,
that's
had passed away in the fifth season, or if it was something that Rick had instilled as well. But it was a hard, fast rule that everyone kind of understood. And that's just the way the work went.
Okay.
There was no, nobody, look, I'm sure that the writers would have preferred to be able to go down to the set. But
I have heard
there's no way it was a Roddenberry thing, because he was a notorious rewriter on set.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's also interesting. Like I've heard the stories from D-Space-9 producer Iris Stephen Bear in various conventions and stuff like that. And he would always specifically say this phrase of like, "Oh, I snuck down for that episode," or "I snuck down." Yeah. And I would be like, "You're the executive producer. Why do you have
You're
to sneak
guy
on
in
the
charge.
Set?"
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I mean, maybe it's just how Rick came from.
And we're talking about Rick Berman, in case anybody is not clear.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Rick Berman. And he came from the studio side. So his involvement with Star Trek, he was like the vice president in charge of, I think it was long form entertainment or something for the studio. And his involvement started when Roddenberry pitched this new show and they were talking about, you know, possibly putting it in syndication. It was the first time that a new show would be going to syndication rather than reruns of something. And so Rick was in on those meetings from the studio side. And in talking to Rick about it, you know, there were a lot of arguments that would happen. Roddenberry was keen on pushing back for things he believed in. And the studio was very staunch about their belief in certain things. And Rick said, and I would step in and kind of calm everything down. He said, and then, you know, Gene would ask me to lunch and they would talk about everything except Star Trek. You know, Rick has traveled the world and had a really interesting background, and Gene had traveled the world. And so they talked about their passion for travel and all these different things. And then eventually Gene said, "How would you like to be a producer on the show?" And so it was a big step for Rick, and a big decision. I mean, he had a pregnant wife at home, and, you know, this was a real gamble. I mean, a syndicated hour-long show, the first one, and could you capture lightning in a bottle again with Star Trek? I mean, there's a lot of questions, but he and his wife decided, you know, that it was worth the shot, and they did. And so I think maybe a lot of the mentality of how to run the show came from Rick's training on the studio side.
Okay, that makes sense that he's coming to it from more of a studio executive side.
For sure. But now that we're starting to tread into different shows and your experience there, I wanted to ask Dave if you could speak about like different challenges that you experienced working on each show. What was unique about them? How were the sets different? Because there's a lot of famous actor stories about how sets were different that we've heard, but let's hear about it from your side.
When you say how the sets were different,
So for me, it comes to mind, and Jason has like brought up a protracted version of the story a lot, that on the TNG set and the Voyager set, it was like lighter and more fun. And on like DS9, it seemed to have a much more serious tone.
The classic story that I heard at Star Trek Las Vegas convention was, there's a very famous story with Armin Shimerman and Ethan Phillips. And Armin Shimerman would say that he was like, on our set, he was like, or he's on the Voyager set, he was like, you would call your captain Kathy. On our set, it was, "Hello, Mr. Brooks." So from that story, I've always in tune that the DS9 set was probably a more serious set. Whereas I know from everything, all the back behind the scenes and interviews I've seen of the TNG set, it felt like it was a bunch of pranksters. You know, the actors all felt like they were like kind of joking on each other, whereas the Deep Space Nine set kind of feels like
they went to work.
We're here to work.
Yeah, that's I think that's true. Yes, absolutely. The Next Generation set was, again, had a very family kind of feeling, and there was a lot of laughter that went on, and they were enjoying themselves quite a bit. And so when Deep Space Nine started, it was in the last season of Next Gen. And then soon after, Voyager was being developed. And so what happened was, to get everything going and have the right amount of or an amount of kind of know-how for how these shows worked, the productions were split. So certain people went to Deep Space Nine to kind of shepherd that in, and then other people went to Voyager, and these were all people who had worked all through Next Generation. But of course, you know, we had to hire cinematographers and things, and those people stayed on Deep Space Nine, whereas the Next Gen people kind of moved to Voyager. And
which set did you make the jump to?
I was mostly on Voyager.
Okay.
Working with Mary Howard. So after my stint as a PA, Mary hired me as her personal assistant, and I did that for a few years. And Mary was, she went from unit production manager to line producer on Voyager. And so that's where that sort of happened. And then I made the jump over to being Rick's assistant. And then I kind of dabbled in a little of everything, because at that point, Rick, you know, the shows were so all-consuming for him. Mm-hmm. He would get to work and be in an editing room or with the writers all day. But there was still a lot of the studio side that was going on, right? So they still wanted to do merchandise for consumer products, and they still wanted to do various licensing deals with things, and they wanted to do, you know, publicity shoots and you know, all of these different promotion and all of these different things that have to happen. And Rick realized that he didn't have the time to do it all. And frankly, his attention had to be on the shows. So he created a position called Supervisor of Star Trek Projects and kind of named me in his
great
contract.
Title.
I was just, Dave, that's
I want that on a t-shirt.
That is great, because this is something that I think a lot of people that, and again, I hate to say this term, that don't work in the industry, the Hollywood industry, don't realize is that, yeah, people in Rick Berman's position or showrunners and stuff like that just do not have the bandwidth to do all this stuff. You know, so I was just about to ask you, I was going to be like, oh, were you responsible for like the Super Nintendo game, Star Trek, Starfleet Academy? Like what like things did you greenlight that like you're secretly responsible for? I would, if there are any that popped to mind.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there was a lot of stuff coming across my desk at the time. And,
are you responsible for all the Playmates toys?
Well, I wasn't responsible for them, but I certainly, so I would have I don't remember if it was biweekly or monthly or something, a meeting with these various divisions, and the consumer products group was the biggest. And so I would go to the Marathon building on the lot, and they had this huge conference room, and it would be full. I mean, there would be people all around this huge table, and they would just kind of go around the room and say, here's what we're doing for toys. Here's what we're doing for comic books. Here's what we're doing for novels. Here's what we're, you know, they would just go around and get my input. And, you know, it was a matter of Rick felt comfortable because first I had a knowledge of Star Trek that was keen from a fan point of view, but also I understood his, you know,
his
feeling
tone,
on certain
maybe,
things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was good. Like, you know, look, there were times where this is a funny idea, but what if the Enterprise was on condoms? You know, I mean, it was like, you know, and they would,
wow.
You know, they do it in a way that's,
I bet it was pitched. Well,
you know, they say it in a way that is half joking. But half of it isn't joking because they're just trying to gauge your response.
Course,
you know what I mean? And so, yeah, there was stuff that obviously worked and stuff that didn't work. But, you know, one of my favorite bits was when we did, because I'm a big comic book fan, and we did the X-Men TNG crossover comic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with Marvel, and it was really fun. That's where I met, you know, I met a lot of people working there. I met a guy named Chip Carter, who to this day is one of my best friends. He was the best man at my wedding. I met my wife there. She was part of the licensing group at the time.
Oh.
And so I met a lot of great people, but yeah, there were a lot of things that came across my desk, that I had to look at. And, you know, if it was kind of a high level thing, and there's no way I could look at everything, and there's just no way, but if it was something that was kind of high item, high profile, things like video games and things like that, yes, I had input into them. I couldn't tell you, you know, case by case what my input was at the time. There was just a ton going on.
Well, we prepared a list, Dave. No, I'm kidding.
Go. But yeah, there was a lot of stuff, and it was a really, really fun job. But I noticed that, you know, as I was doing it, it moved me farther away from production, in the sense that, you know, I really missed hanging out down on the stages, and I missed, you know, a lot of that stuff. Like the, and you know, interacting with the cast was always really fun.
Well, I just want to say that it's so funny. There's another podcast out there, everybody. If you don't listen to it, it's called The Delta Flyers, and it's hosted by Garrett Wong and Robert Duncan McNeil, who played Tom Paris and Harry Kim on Star Trek Voyager. And Dave, I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you even listen to that podcast. Do you?
I don't typically listen to it, but I did get a lot of tags at one point because I was mentioned on the podcast.
They have mentioned you several times.
Oh, Dave, you're so famous.
And they absolutely love you. And that's a thing.
That's
like,
so sweet.
And that's a thing about every time they've brought you up, they're like, oh, it was probably Dave. Dave's so great.
And that's true across all industries, mm-hmm. not just entertainment. Is if you are good, mm-hmm. people will speak well of you.
Yeah. So like, I understand like, so what, yeah, I understand like you wanting to go back to the cast, because again, like whatever magic and mojo you use, they love you, man. They talk very fondly about you.
Oh, that's really kind. I mean, they were all great groups of people. Like the Deep Space Nine cast, to kind of go back to what you were talking about.
Tell us about Mr. Brooks.
Well,
look, I'm certain Avery is lovely, and I would die to meet him one day. I kid. I'm sorry, Avery.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, or Mr. Brooks.
Don't talk about my space dad like that.
Yeah, you know, look, he was a very serious person, and I think that there was, I think there were certain cases where, people were at odds over different things. I don't know if it was their interpersonal relationships. I couldn't tell you what brought it about, but it was a little bit more of a stern set. And that's not to say that they weren't very nice people. Mm-hmm. They certainly were. Mm-hmm. And it was great talking to all of them and, you know, getting to know them. But yeah, there was a point where Avery came up to the, and that's how it was, right? You didn't call Patrick Mr. Stewart. You called him Patrick, right? And it was just, you know, you were working together. That was the feeling on the Next Generation set. But there was a point where Avery, you know, wanted to be called Mr. Brooks, which, you know, he's the star of the show.
He's the top of the call list. Yeah.
He's the top of the call list.
If he makes that request, you got to do it.
Yeah. And so there, and I know that there were times when, you know, there was some friction in that. If people weren't called from their trailers, you know, in the appropriate sequence, that could be a problem. That could, you know, I remember, at one point as a gift for someone, I got a baseball and I was going to have everyone sign the baseball.
Mm.
And in the time I was doing it, Avery wasn't on the call sheet for the day I was doing it. So the next day I came in and I asked him to sign it and, you know, he was like, well, you're coming to me now? You know, there was this very definite kind of feeling of, why wasn't I the first one to sign it? And it's a very uncomfortable feeling. you know, to
yeah, I understand that, but you know, I'll
like, let me just have a time travel episode and we'll redo this.
Look, you know what? You know what? But I will totally, I'll totally give him a pass on that. I understand there's a bit uncomfortable, but I'm going to just put that to that. He took the role as like, I am the captain.
Yeah.
I am the lead, you know, of this, like maybe a little bit more seriously than he should have. But that would be a very weird situation. And that is the type of stuff that on sets, when you get into the power dynamics, that it becomes very awkward. Now, you were mentioning earlier, Dave, about getting back to the cast. And because by the time you got to Star Trek Enterprise, you become an associate producer. So I want to talk about, like, you were managing all these franchises. Everybody from consumer products were pitching these things. You were responsible for X-Men, Star Trek. I'm putting it out right there.
He wrote it. He drew it. He inked it. He colored it. He lettered it. Dave Rossi is your man.
You told Peter David what to put in every single panel.
Peter David didn't. Peter David didn't know my name, but he didn't like me.
Oh no!
I can tell you that.
Look, from some of the stories I've heard, I don't know if Peter David likes many people, but we'll move on.
Because we would give notes on his stuff, and he really did not like receiving.
Well, now
notes.
He's never coming on the show, Jason.
I'm a big fan of Peter David, creator of Spider-Man 2099, but I don't know if Peter knows what podcast this. Anyways, moving on. So you were managing all this, like, sort of the outsidery, the consumer products, all these things that Rick didn't have time for. But, like, you eventually, I know you've told me the story off air before about how you, like, sort of maneuvered your way, I believe, into the Star Trek Voyager writer's room. Am I correct about this?
That's right. In the sixth season of Voyager, you know, I was feeling like I wanted, like I was moving further away from production, which, again, I had no intention when I started this journey of being in television. And now that I've had time and clarity to kind of look back on it, what was really intriguing to me was that it was Star Trek. That was the big thing for me. And that's where my passion for it came from. The idea of going back into television now is not something that's appealing to me. They're very long hours, and, you know, I'm just not there. But at that time, I wanted to be more involved. And so for the sixth season of Voyager, I went to Rick and I said, listen, I would love to, for this season, sit in on everything. I'll shut my mouth, but I want to sit in on
be the wallflower, the
writers meetings, the production meetings, the, you know, everything, casting sessions, whatever it is, I would love to sit in on it. And he was like, okay, as long as you shut your mouth and you don't, you know, don't jump in, I'll tell everybody that you're going
to
be sitting.
And you were like, don't you dare talk to me that, Mr. Berman. You hear the things I told Peter David what to do.
No, he doesn't call him Mr. Berman in that scenario. He calls him Ricky.
That's right.
Oh, boy. Listen, Ricky.
Do you know who I think I am?
But what a fascinating education. Like, that's
it was great.
Yeah, you would have learned every aspect. Well, let me ask you this. This is a quick follow-up question to this. Since you got to see it all, like, sort of through Rick Berman's eyes and things like that, what's something unique about producing Star Trek that you think most people don't even think about? Like, what's something you know about creating the brand or the
say their names?
Oh, no. I'm not even asking for something specific. What is something that, like, many people that have never worked on Star Trek would never even consider that is something you got to keep in mind or something that Rick did very well about producing Star Trek?
Well, listen, I'm sure everybody knows that, you know, look, there's a lot of talk out there about Rick's tenure on the show and a lot of vitriol about it. And the one thing that I will say is whether you agree with him creatively or not, because going from show to show to show, I don't think the show did evolve enough. You know, it was a very kind of, the circumstances changed for the story, but it was always a group of seven main character. You know what I mean? It was a very kind of a formulaic structure.
Oh yeah. You knew what kind of meatloaf you were getting with Star Trek in the 90s or early.
Completely.
90s. Yeah,
completely. But I'll tell you the one thing that Rick always did, and that was he followed through on Gene's vision for this, or tried to, which was very hard because he doesn't believe in a vision where, you know, he doesn't necessarily think we're going to be at Star Trek in the 23rd century. So he has a much more harsh kind of view of the world, I think. And to, for all those years he was on the show, to come in every day and carry someone else's vision, I think, is it's a monumental task. And again, where he, you know, where he stumbled or where he succeeded is certainly up for debate. But you know, that's, I think, you're dealing with something here that is the vision of another person. And if you stray too far from that, you're not at that thing anymore. There's an evolution and then there's a change. And I think it's a hard thing to straddle. And Rick tried to stay always in that sweet spot. And I think that was a difficult thing to do.
I will say this, you know, whatever anybody out there listening thinks about Rick Berman, the fact that Star Trek stayed on the air was basically, I would consider, the first shared cinematic universe mm-hmm. with a movie and two TV shows running at the same time. Huge toys, comics, books. The books were legendary. Conventions, video games. And that lasted for about 18 years. I think, to be honest with you, has more to do with Rick Berman than I think Gene Roddenberry. The fact that he was able to keep it going. And I think the thing we're learning about this episode is that Mr. Dave Rossi had a big part in that as mm-hmm. well. We want to ask you a question. Ashley has a question for you, Dave, that is very specific to this podcast.
we've talked a little bit. We've talked a little bit about Enterprise, but I want to ask you specifically about your time on Enterprise, because we recently had Dominic Keating on the show and he told a bunch of stories about people. So I would love to ask you about Enterprise, but also sub question, do you have a Dominic Keating story?
You know, it's so by the time Enterprise came along, that's when I had really, and especially after spending that season on Voyager, going through all those different meetings and things and kind of learning out, I went to Rick and said, listen, I want to be more involved in the production. And I don't know what that means for this show, but you know, what can we do to get me more involved? And so he worked with Mary Howard and they put me in charge of inserts and second unit. Mm. And for those who don't know, basically, when you're filming an episode, there are times where, whether it's a visual effect that's going to take more setup than you have time to do, or kind of little snippets like, it's important that you see Archer's hand grab this weapon as a close-up. Mm. You don't necessarily want to film that with all the actors waiting.
And something I think most people don't realize, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, I didn't realize this until very recently, every time you point the camera at the view screen, that was an insert shot too, correct? Or most of the time?
Most of the time, yes, yeah. Absolutely. And so you, what you would do is you would collect these kind of snippets of shots across three or four scripts. And then we would have a meeting with the second unit staff and the editors would be there. And so they would say, well, this is what we need. And you would budget it and schedule it. And then you would have a day where one day on the various stages, you would shoot all of those things for all of those episodes. So you would have hand doubles and, you know, if you needed someone in a certain costume or if you needed a prop or whatever. And so we would do all that. And it was really, really fun. But it also, I didn't interact with that cast very much. Mm. So between what I was doing on the studio side and trying to get second unit ready, the days of me just kind of going on down to the stage and hanging out were kind of gone. So I didn't really have that interaction with the cast, like I did on, you know, on Voyager and Next Gen.
Then let's ask you this follow-up question then. What is a secret to insert acting, since you had to be in charge of so many of these shots? What is something about picking up the phaser or picking up the tricorder or the close-up of firing the torpedoes? What is something that you have to like keep in mind with that, that many people don't even realize?
Well, it's all about continuity, I think, is the important thing. So, you know, we would have these TV monitors down there along with the take, right? Because you have to watch what's coming before and what's coming after to understand how the angle of the camera that you want to be. You don't want to cross any lines or do anything weird or jarring. And so it's a lot of continuity stuff. And, you know, it sounds kind of obvious that well, when you see somebody's hands come in and press buttons, it's, you know, it seems easy enough to do, but it's not. It's, you know, it's, it can look silly because these, they're not real buttons, and it can, you know, so the way that you have to kind of talk to the hand, and a lot of the hand extras were people that are extras on the show. So they're there all day. They kind of get it. It was, again, it was,
did you ever put your hand in one of these shots? Are you in an, are you in a Star Trek Enterprise or a Star Trek Voyager shot as a hand or a foot or a door opening?
No, no, I never did that. The closest I got is I am the voice of Henry Starling's assistant.
In the Future's End Star Trek Voyager episode?
In Future's End, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Oh, wow.
And they did that as that was supposed to be Rick was Starling and I was me. That was the direction I got, which was kind of funny. So,
okay, with that in mind, because this might be your answer, but what is your favorite episode of Star Trek that you've worked on?
Oh, my God.
Pick your favorite child.
Yeah, that's tough. I would have to say, oh boy, I'm going to say Unification Part 2, which is actually bittersweet because, so obviously Leonard Nimoy, big part in those two episodes, and be able to meet Spock
just for anybody listening. Yeah, that was the Star Trek Next Generation episode where Spock finally guest starred. Leonard Nimoy himself guest starred on that franchise.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was also the episode, I believe, we were filming when Gene died.
Oh.
And I remember, you know, I was a PA at the time, and I remember we would convert our production, where we would have our production meetings, was this big kind of cavernous room. There were like, you know, we would set up these 8-foot tables in a big square so everyone could sit around the perimeter of the room and we could have these meetings. But when we weren't using it for that, we would break all the tables down and use it for casting sessions. And so we were in the process of setting up the room. We were setting up the tables to have it be a production meeting. And the script we were working on was A Matter of Time. And I remember we were laying these scripts out on the table. And at that time, in Channel 9 news was in a stage behind our production offices, and reporters just started kind of pouring in, and they would talk to anyone. They were just coming into people. They didn't know who anyone was. And they were just like, do you have a response to the death of Gene Roddenberry? And that's how we found out. It's a kind of a bittersweet moment, but meeting Leonard Nimoy was, you know, the original series is really my holy grail as far as that thing goes. I mean, I've had some incredible chances to interact with that series, even though it was way off the air. I met DeForest Kelly on a stage one time. They had brought him in to do some, they were doing some special on medicine of the future and, you know, Star Trek medicine or something. And they had DeForest Kelly come in, and he was standing on stage 8, which wasn't being used at the time, but they had our craft service set up in there. And he was there alone. There was no one else there. And I walked onto the stage and saw him. And I just was compelled to go up and say to him, you know, what an impact he had on my life. And he talked to me for about 20 minutes. Just, what do you want to do in the business? And what's it like working here? And this is how Star Trek was a little different for us. And, you know, it's a much, you know, more relaxed seems to be here than it was back then.
That's great. That just like confirms that he was a nice guy, because if you're willing to talk to anybody, no matter their status or rank or anything like that, and just like have a normal conversation, that means you're a good person. So that's completely great to hear that Dr. McCoy was a good old Southern gentleman, as some would say.
Yeah, he really, really was just the sweetest man. And, you know, and then one of the other kind of quick stories is, every year, William Shatner, I don't know if he still does it, but every year he would do this celebrity horse show at the Burbank Equestrian Center. Mm-hmm. And it was to raise money to have developmentally disabled children and adults and I think soldiers as well use animals for rehabilitation. And so he would raise money for these efforts. And one of the things that they would do is they would have a silent auction to raise a lot of money. And one of the items that they always requested from us was a non-speaking walk-on role. So if you...
Oh, that's cute. That's lovely.
Yeah. So if you won the auction, you would call us and we would schedule you to be in an episode as usually as a Starfleet officer. But if your body type didn't gel with what that was, we would make you an alien. And so you had
honestly,
no lines.
Rather
you
be just, an alien.
Yeah, it'd be cool, right?
Especially the Klingon with a gold sash, right?
Look, I want to be an Andorian.
And so that fell to me to wrangle for some reason. And after doing it for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I get a call from William Shatner's office and his assistant says, Rick would like to, Bill would like to take you to lunch. And, you know,
they say casually,
and you were, you know, you were silent for 2 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, and I said, you mean he wants to take Rick to lunch? And she said, no, he would like to take you to lunch to thank you for all the times you've kind of wrangled this stuff for us. And I was just like, what are you talking about? And she said, yeah, is there anything you don't like for lunch? And there's this little tiny voice in my head yelling, fish, say fish, you hate fish. But I was like, no, everything's fine. And she goes, great, because Bill loves this sushi place on Ventura Boulevard. And so I end up going to meet him for lunch. And for an hour and a half, me and William Shatner are having lunch together. And it was just like one of the most surreal moments of my life. I mean, so to have those things happen. And then, you know, I also got to meet Leonard Nimoy. And I mean, it was just so I would say unification, but also and all those things that have touchstones to the original series, you know, Jimmy Doohan being on
Relics.
His episode and
mm-hmm.
on Relics. And those are probably my favorite episodes.
Well, Dave, let me ask you this question as our final question. What advice would you have to any listeners that are hearing this podcast that really want an opportunity to work on one of their favorite franchises like you did? Like what piece of advice would you give them for like the longevity you've had and just the fact of like what you think is the secret sauce that has like kept you basically around Star Trek and working on Star Trek? Cause you've had a heck of a rise. So what advice would you have for these listeners that are looking for the way to be the next you basically?
Well, it's tricky. The news is not all great. You know, I got incredibly lucky and was in the right place at the right time. I would say that if you want to be involved in this business, just start. In anything, don't aim for your favorite show because that might not happen. But there's always ways to kind of, you know, you and I'm speaking for someone who didn't follow any of this. So I know it comes off as maybe kind of insincere, but I was just so lucky to be where I was at the time. But it took a connection to get there. Right. Mm-hmm. I didn't just do it by myself. It took Eric Stillwell and meeting people. And so I would say get into the business any way you can get in and then make your connections and try and aim yourself in that direction. But beyond that, make yourself indispensable and be kind and be, you know, it's a very small business and people who have bad behavior, that gets out, it gets around, and you will find yourself on the outside. So I would say just always be available, always be kind, always be willing to help rather than hinder. And you know, hope for that bit of luck that can kind of spark the right being in the right place at the right time. But certainly build a network. You know, it's funny, Brad Yacobian, who's a UPM, who was a UPM on the show, I went into his office one day and he had this book out on his desk and he was making a phone call and he gave me the kind of one finger up, like, hang on just 1 second. He was finishing leaving a message and he hung up the phone and I said, what's the book? And he said, oh, this is my production book. He said, I call every year, I take this out and I call everyone in it And I just say, how you doing? How you, are you working? I'm still working on Star Trek. And he said, and I just keep those contacts up because you just never know when someone's going to need your help or you're going to need someone's help. And now, unfortunately for me, Star Trek was the only, I didn't really have a chance to build that portfolio. Once the show ended, I moved on to a different division at Paramount because, again, it wasn't so much TV that I was interested in that I learned. It was Star Trek. And so it didn't quite work out for me that way. But for people who are interested in being in this business, I would say just get yourself in and do the best work you can do and be the kindest you can be. And people remember that.
I think that's good life advice as well, not just work advice.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And listeners, if you want to hear more with Dave Rossi, more Star Trek stories, we're going to dive a little bit more into the Star Trekiness. I know we've been deep in Star Trek, but we're going to go even more into Star Trek. You can come check us over at patreon.com/Jawin. That's J-A-W-I-I-N, where we do all kinds of exclusive podcasts for supporting the show. And thank you to our super friends who already support us. Dave, can you please tell our listeners where they can find you online? And is there any upcoming projects that you can chat about or hint at? Or I'm not certain if you're so far up the, you have become, in my opinion, the grand poobah up there in Paramount. And I don't know whether there's this stuff you just can't talk about. So,
I work for the division now that licenses out our properties into international theme parks. I can tell you that, you know, we are always working with CBS and Star Trek to try and bring a Star Trek land to life. So that work continues. There's nothing yet, but I can tell you that we're always trying to develop things introduce Star Trek in a physical way to people so that you can immerse yourself in it. But nothing I can really talk about. But if you want to find me, I am available on, I'm on the Twitters at underscore it means hope. And if you're confused about maybe there's another Dave Rossi out there, my symbol is the Delta symbol with a Superman symbol in place of the star. It's a licensing nightmare.
It's the combination of both of your fandoms. Well, Dave, thank you so much for being so awesome on this show. We really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you so much. It was really a lot of fun.
And listeners out there, don't forget that you can follow this podcast. Where on social media, Ashley?
You can find us at geekhistorylesson.com, facebook.com/geekhistorylesson, or on Twitter at GHLpodcast.
And you can follow Ashley on Instagram and Twitter at Ashley V. Robinson. You can follow myself on Twitter and Instagram at Jawin. That's J-A-W-I-I-N. One final thank you to Mr. Dave Rossi, the man that we are saying is responsible for Star Trek X-Men. Thank you so much for joining us, Dave.
Thank you, guys.
And thank you so much, everybody, for listening. This has been Geek History Lesson. I am Jason, still a big fan of Peter David. Please, this has all been jokes, sir. Inman.
I am Ashley Victoria Robinson, and Professor Jason, would you please dismiss the class?
Class is dismissed.